Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the South Asian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I am Madhuri, the host of your channel. And today we are talking to Sujata Gidla about her new book, her first book, Ants Among Elephants, An Untouchable Family and the Making of Modern India. Sujata, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Madhuri, and thanks, everyone.
And Sujata, I wonder if you will begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, your journey from Andhra Pradesh to this book.
I was born in Andhra. I grew up in a small town called Kakinada. Because of my parents, being educated and employed, they steered us in the direction of, education. I ended up in IIT Madras. There, I saw everybody applying and going to America. So I did the same, and that's how I ended up here. But on the other hand, my aspirations and my expectations in the U.S. Are different from average Indians who come here. I wanted to see a different way of life and experience living in a freer, if not of course it's not the freest, but a freer society than Indian society. And that's how I came up here.
Right. And you trained as an engineer, and yet you write this beautiful spare prose that's so hard hitting. How did you come to take up the pen?
Oh, well, people say a lot of times, like, oh, you studied science. How did you become a writer? How could you write? But it's like, you're a doctor, and how could you play golf or something? I don't think mutually exclusive. And the second thing is probably that my training in science, as well as my exposure to Marxism, shaped the way I wrote, sparing, minimum, and no flourish.
Right. And you really let the reader deal with the content of your prose rather than get carried away with beautiful writing. Not that the two are mutually exclusive, but you begin the book by talking us through how this book itself was a process of self-discovery for you too, right? That you went back to your family members, talked to them again and again, and collected these oral histories. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that process for you?
First, I don't know how it is for other untouchables or for any other person, but I think especially because we were at the receiving end of discrimination, I always wanted to know why it was like that. I came to know that in villages, untouchable parents tell their children, this is how it is, this is who we are. They don't question why they were like that. But for some reason, I was one of those people who questioned. The questioning started with this movie where, I attributed my untouchability to Christianity, it being a minority religion. But then I came across these Syrian Christians who are acting just like Brahmins, Then I said, oh, okay, this religion is not the reason why we are untouchable. So, and I wanted to know. And that's how, the pivotal thing, people won't believe it, but coming across Syrian Christians is what prompted me to probe into my past. So I asked my mother why we were Christians, and then she went on to tell this story. Maybe in, families that are, socially high up, they proudly tell their children their family stories, but it wasn't like that, my family. Nobody told us that until I asked my mother. But once I started talking to her, I found out those stories to be very interesting. Not only that, but they gave an insight into how these how caste works and what makes one untouchable and what are the dynamics of caste. So it was all very interesting to me. So for people who have the same kind of tastes, I thought this would make a good book.
When did you decide at that point that you were going to write all this down and turn it into a book? And how did family members react when you told them that this was actually for a book project?
I think pretty much when my mother told me the first story about how her clan, our clan, came out of the jungles and settled in the plains, that's pretty huge story, you know. I didn't know it before. Like, we crossed a civilizational era, like being from hunter-gatherers to agriculturalists. That took place in our very recent past is very fascinating to me. So I really did think that you know, it's something to tell other people. And then I started writing those stories, and one of my friends posted an excerpt on internet, and somebody saw it and he wanted to include it in Oxford Anthology of Telugu Dalit Writing. So he asked us, and we gave it to him. And he was the one who encouraged and said, this makes a good book. You should write it. And he kept on encouraging me. He was Professor Purushottam Kontam of Kakatiya University. And he also included an excerpt in his English classes textbooks in Kakatiya University and two other universities in Andhra.
That's exciting. How did students respond to your piece?
I never asked that professor, and he never told me anything. But I'm active on social media, and people recognized my name and said, "Oh, madam, you wrote that piece in our textbooks. It's a great piece, and we loved it," and things like that. So I'm sure that it was received well.
So I see your book is coming out in India end of November, right? How are you looking forward to that? Are you excited, a little wary, nervous?
I'm excited. I'm not at all nervous because the publication of the book in America and its reception by Indian readers pretty much told me that they would like it. There's no question about it. Maybe there are some people, Hindu nationalists, people who don't want the rest of the world to know that there is caste system, who are ashamed of it, and yet supporters of it may not like it. And I have heard of, I mean, there's one review or story of it, kind of like denouncing the book. But other than that, I haven't seen anything else except people making comments on blogs and social media. I haven't seen any opposition to the book yet, but probably it would happen once the book comes out in India.
Are you going to be traveling to India to speak with the press and do readings? Are you traveling to India soon to do readings with the press?
Okay. Times of India has a book festival, literature festival in Mumbai. I'm going to that. And then Jaipur Lit Fest next year.
Right. That's very exciting stuff. I also, like you, encountered a blog, including some YouTube comments on your CUNY TV interview, where this Hindu nationalist gentleman berated you for airing India's dirty linen in public and, you know, talking about how India can solve its own problems. So, you know, there are always going to be those kinds of reactions, and your book is writing precisely against those voices, right? I want to ask you a little bit more about your choice of the category untouchable over Dalit. What motivated that?
Sure. Yeah, I prefer untouchable. As you know, untouchables have been called different names in different times, starting from depressed classes, which the British called untouchables, And then Gandhi came along, called them Harijans. And then there is scheduled caste after the reservations were put in constitution. And then the latest being Dalit. Dalit is something that untouchables themselves prefer. But I like to be, you know, from my science background or from Marxist background, want to be precise and scientific. And untouchable is a politically neutral word, which tells exactly what, you know, that community are. So I prefer untouchable than Dalit.
And how do you see yourself in relationship to the current Dalit politics as it's unfolding in India? I mean, you have, you know, daily news of Dalit lynchings, but then you also have emergent Dalit protests. Last year in Gujarat, there was a big pushback against mob violence in Una district. How do you react to reading news about India and Dalit politics here in the U.S.?
So there are two parts to Dalit news. One is the news of atrocities. The second is the pushback. I mean, news of atrocities makes me outraged because it's intensifying more and more. Wider and wider, and the violence is more brutal than ever before, with no sign of abating. You know, something has got to give. It can't go on. And as for the protests, I don't know the people. I mean, there is like a mass outpouring in Una and other places. That is a very welcome sign. But at the same time, I'm not sure. I'm not doubting. I'm just saying that I don't know who the leaders are and where they're leading the whole outrage and mass outpouring, where they're leading it to. I don't know who Mevani is, where he came from. And I'm always skeptical when big leaders come out like suddenly. For example, I'm skeptical about Bheem Army. I mean, the idea is good, but what if it's some vested interests, acting from behind these people? That's how I feel. As for Ambedkarites and other people in America, you know, I'm skeptical of them too, in the sense that who are funding them, what are their real motives? But I'm not saying outright that they're bad, because I don't really know. But I want to take it with a pinch of salt when it comes to people, you know, coming out and leading things. My theory, my principle is follow the money.
Speaking of leaders, you know, the second half of the book, runs on parallel tracks almost, right? You have your mother's story and you have your uncle SM's story. And, you know, on one hand, SM is a revolutionary, he's a poet, he's a people's leader, and he's out there in the forest leading the struggle. But then there's also your mother, who's leading an everyday struggle, right? That she has to fight on two fronts, as a Dalit, but also as a woman raising three children. So both those struggles in some ways are as important, right? And I appreciated how you juxtaposed your mother and your uncle in, you know, this contrasting fashion. Do you want to talk a little bit more about how you see those two aspects coming together and yet somehow seen as separate by the outside world?
I'm not really sure that I understand myself, that there is some kind of organic link between them. I just wrote down how it happened. But I would say that, you know, both of them came from a very marginalized background, and both of them aspired to do things better than their parents did. Him being a man, he was able to do what he wanted to do, despite, he went through all these struggles, different parties, different ideologies and all that stuff. But he went on to do what he wanted to do. Whereas my mother, being a woman, still disadvantaged. Women, Dalit women are doubly expressed, doubly oppressed, in the sense that they're oppressed both by caste and by gender. That's what my mother's struggle was. And so her struggle then remained, how to survive, rather than something more universal, less individual. That's how I see it.
Because leftist struggles all over the world have repeatedly stumbled against this question, right? That of marginalized identities within it, and how to resolve the push and the pull between gender and class, between caste and class. So, in the afterword, when you write about how your uncle was expelled from the party because he went public with caste discrimination within the party itself, how did you feel? You were 16 at the time, right? Were you disillusioned, disenchanted?
I think that, until the point of my arrest, I was very, very passionate about Naxalite politics. My idea was that after I graduate, I was going to go underground and be a guerrilla. Once the arrest happened, a lot of disorientation happened, because, it's evident that Naxalite cadre will get arrested, tortured, or shot, or imprisoned. And there seemed to be no a set program or a strategy on the part of the party how to deal with that thing. Maybe, for example, they have a group of civil rights lawyers dedicated to this, or some kind of strategy to bail people out. None of that. There was nothing like that. It was like we were left to hang dry. That came as a surprise to me, because, they have these plans that they have, for leaders to have dens and secret dens and couriers and, disguises. Why didn't they have such strategies or plans or some tricks to deal for us to deal with? Actually, I'm one of the lucky ones, because I escaped, but there are people who were shot dead. The menial workers, the Regional Engineering College mess workers, who were arrested at the same time, they have never come back. I think that they were shot dead. You can't just leave people like that, to fend for themselves. That is wrong on the part to do that. And second thing is, immediately after that, that thing came out that my uncle was expelled. So it was kind of disorienting, but at the same time, I was not completely disillusioned. And then I went to IIT Madras, and there was no atmosphere there of leftist politics. So that was somewhat, loosened me from my passion. And when I came to America, then I realized reading stuff that, I wanted to reject guerrilla path for revolution. I still think a revolution is needed. I still think that a change is urgent and necessary, but I don't think that guerrilla warfare is the way to go.
So what is the way to go, in your opinion? Mass mobilizations?
Of course, yeah. Guerrilla strategy, it sounds very militant and very heroic and romantic, but when it comes down to it, it's petty bourgeois in its ideology, in the sense that, okay, a group of us who are very intelligent, very courageous, and willing to sacrifice, will liberate the whole you know, country. That's a very elitistic view of things, even though it looks very, you know, romantic and great and adventurous. And I think that, you know, the other problem with guerrilla warfare is that, you know, how many, you can have all kinds of weapons and stuff, but can anyone ever match the state's capacity, its, you know, for inflicting violence? They have nuclear bombs, for example. Can guerrillas, you know, match that? They cannot. So what they need to look at is, what do you have in your hand that can make them come down to their knees? And it's the working class. Working class doesn't need to take up weapons, you know. They can say that we don't want to work today. We don't want to work for a month if you don't do this. And that's how, that is where the power lies. It's what is called the social power. And that social power lies in the hands of the working class, not in the hands of guerrillas. And as an example, I'll give you this, that in 2005, MTA workers went on strike, and it was Christmas season, rush. Mm-hmm. And 2 days, just 2 days, they stopped service. And Wall Street came to a screeching halt. That's the kind of power they had. They didn't have to use weapons. They have the power of withholding their work. That is where to look for bringing about change.
Wow, that's very inspiring. Thank you for sharing your vision. So now that you're in the US, are you still involved or engaged in leftist politics or Dalit politics back in Andhra?
No, not formally engaged. I don't belong to your party. I don't follow one particular Dalit strand of Dalit movement. I do just generally follow it, hoping that in future there is something that will come out of it that's effective and the right direction to go. Until then, yeah, just onlooker and following the news.
Well, I think writing this book is definitely an act of engagement. So, you know, I wouldn't describe you as sitting on the fence at all, in fact. But so
I don't think of myself as sitting on the fence, not just because I wrote a book, but I'm looking at things and see what will happen and what to do in future, you know.
Right. Waiting and learning and observing. Exactly. I want to ask you about writing on this volatile, difficult, painful topic, specific to India, but in the US, right? And in several interviews, you draw a comparison between the American experience of racism with caste discrimination back in India. And it's a powerful analogy, right? And activists too have gone back and forth on drawing on the experience of race and the experience of caste to come up with a solidarity platform. And, you know, historically, it's been less successful at one point and more at others. How have people responded to you making this analogy?
It's kind of like, you know, Fox 5 News, they were doing an interview with me. They had me sitting on a stoop of a brownstone in Fort Greene. And the guy was talking to me and people were passing by. And it's a kind of a black neighborhood. And people started gathering and they were spellbound, you know, when I was talking about race and caste. They were going about their business and they just stopped and they were listening to it. And then they thanked me afterwards to, you know, say that they learned something. And in India, the conscious Dalits, Dalits who are able to watch on TV what goes on in America, they do definitely identify with black people in America. And black people will too, except that they don't get news of Indian caste system as much as Indians get news of racism in America. And I think that I'm not a social scientist or an anthropologist to make, academically correct comparisons between race and caste. But from all superficial on the surface, there are so many similarities that it's hard to miss. The first and foremost is that the discrimination is based on your birth, to whom you were born. You know, in case of Americans, it is you're born from somebody who came from Africa. That is what determines their status in the society. And the second thing is segregation. You know, I mean, even though Jim Crow has been dismantled, there is no question that there is rampant discrimination in housing for Black people. My coworkers tell me that it's almost impossible to get housing in places where there are no Black people, you know. So those two things are very, very similar. And then there are all those other things that marrying an upper caste girl is forbidden. So is, Emmett Till in 1940s, was it, that he was killed because he was supposed to have whistled at a white woman. That's very similar, isn't it?
I'm surprised that, that point is not made more often and more evocatively. And it's great that in your public speaking, you're making that connection over and over again. And especially, in the last year, there's been so much violence against Africans in India that it's almost as if you're bringing it full circle, right? You're pointing out how deeply racist upper caste urban Indians can be. And I thought, how in the US, liberals will say, oh, but we live in a post-racist world. We don't see any racism, just as in India, you'll have urban, upper caste Indians talking about living in a post-castist world, right? So that's, again, yet another similarity. So how have you felt when, the incidents of students, Dalit students committing suicide in India were playing out? Because while reading your book and, when your mother gets a second class in Benares after having studied so hard and done so well, and all her professors acknowledging her hard work and brilliance, and yet there she was. And that was what, 30, 40 years ago, and yet so little has changed. How do you feel when you encounter these incidents?
When it happened to my mother, my mother was, okay, that happened to me. It was awful. It's very, strange and things like that. And then it happened to my sister, and then she didn't know how to express it, like, oh, this is happening to me, help me or something. She went crazy because she was being repeatedly failed in anatomy. So it was all like, individual experiences that they didn't think that was a widespread thing. But it comes out after the 80s that this thing is a systemic thing, it's not written in the books, but that is what happens to Dalit students everywhere. It's not something that happens to one person like my mother or second person to like my sister, but it's a thing. And the thing is that there is a reason that they discriminate Dalits in universities. Even the perpetrators may not know why they are discriminating, why they are harassing. But the real material basis for it is that Dalits must be confined to doing agricultural labors. If they don't do agriculture labor, who will do it? Then we must confine these people, force these people to confine themselves to earning livelihood from working on the fields of the landlords. And this is one way of discouraging Dalit students from pursuing anything other than agricultural labor. That is the reason why they harass Dalit students to hang themselves or quit studies and go back somewhere.
Right. So it's an institutional violence that's structured in such a way that it keeps out Dalits from avenues of social mobility, right?
Yeah, it's a, what they do in rural India is to force, they force untouchables to stay in their place by violence. And what they do, the same thing in universities is by, instead of killing them, they drive them to kill themselves. The violence is the same kind of violence. The purpose of the violence in both places is the same purpose, to keep them where they belong, in agricultural fields as laborers.
You state that really powerfully. I appreciate your phrasing of that, that dynamic. So your family, have they all read the book?
I'm sure my mother read it, and my uncle died. Both my uncles died. My father died a long time ago. And my siblings, I think that they were very anxious about the book, what I have written, whether, you know, I've been telling them that I wrote this book, I'm writing this book, and they didn't know whether that book will be good book or not good book, whether people will receive it, you know, well or not. So I think that they refrained from looking at it, refrained from reading it. But once, you know, the New York Times article came, it was a big validation for them. I think my sister reads it in, you know, in parts, like this part first, that part first. I don't know what my brother does, but I'm sure he's reading it too.
And what have they said to you about it?
My sister is very into it. My sister is more passionate than any one of us about, you know, discrimination and the treatment of Dalits, because she experienced it more than any of us. She's very much involved. She was very happy that I was able to say these things to outside world. And she keeps saying, you know, in India, we don't have any people on our side, and Westerners are on our side for some reason, and we must keep them. You know, she says that at any cost. That's her reaction, and she's very happy about it. My brother doesn't talk much, but my mother, as you might have guessed, she's very, very proud and very engaged with the book. And she made a lot of enemies because of that. She had her colleagues, 50, 60 of them, for the last 40 years. All of them left her en masse upon publication of this book, because most of them are Brahmins, and they're very violently displeased with the publication of the book. They called her and said things. How dare your daughter write this thing? How dare you talk about us like this? Have we not treated you like one of us for all these years? You know, that kind of stuff. So she really, really lost a lot in terms of her friend circles. But she doesn't seem to care that much.
That's very brave of her, and by extension you. And I just also want to note my appreciation for how you don't make you don't give the Western reader, you don't let them off easy, right, with details. You don't use italics. You don't assume that they won't understand, or that, you know, you should use footnotes, or you don't mollycoddle or babysit a non-Indian reader, right? You just tell it like it is. And I really appreciate that. Was that a conscious decision on your part to not care if they got all the details or not? You were just going to say it anyway?
I wanted to say it the way I wanted, because, you know, even though I lived here a long time, when I think the language idiom I use is Telugu idiom, and that's what I did. And so I stuck with it until editors came along and said that change this or explain this. And I said, it won't work if I explain this. So they had to listen to me. And I think that it worked out well. Nobody is complaining.
Right. And I've read some reviews which said that, you know, for somebody unfamiliar with India's complexity, might find it challenging, but you get the big picture. And I think that's the real victory, right? That you keep the details and yet they get the big picture. So that's really what's amazing. Is there a new project in the pipeline? Are you continuing to write something else, or what's on the horizon?
I thought of this writing project as three books. One is history from the beginning of our family as far back as we can remember up to independence. I was going to make it the first book. And then from independence to 1970s, when my mother's thing resolved in one way or the other, and my uncle going underground, and me just understanding the world, that should be the second book. And then I thought the third book would be my story from when I was 7 years old until I came here. That was the original plan. So I submitted the first book, you know, from the nomadic tribes in jungle to independence. But when I submitted it, the editors felt that it felt like a cliffhanger, the end of it. And it felt like it was unsatisfying end. So they wanted me to add more story. When I did add, it became a huge, huge book of 600 pages. So what I did was I condensed the whole first book into one chapter, which I called Prologue. So that book is still there because it's not just that much which is there currently in the book. There's a lot more to it, a lot more stories there, and a lot more, I don't know. It's very lyrical, the past. So that book is still there, and I'm going to ask them to publish that book. So then that would be the second book. And the next project will be my own story. And I don't know how successful it will be because my story is definitely not as colorful as my uncle's story.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, won't we? Well, Sujata, thank you so much for joining us. All the best for your future ventures. I'm already excited to read whatever else you have lined up. And I know I enjoyed this one, and I hope that our listeners pick up a copy as soon as they hear you speak about it here. So
thanks, Madhuri, and thanks, everyone.
All right, take care. So that was Sujata Gidla talking about her Ants Among Elephants, An Untouchable Family, and the Making of Modern India. It came out this year from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you.